Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today I'm joined by James Dauma again. He is a frequent guest on my channel, expert on machine learning, and we've been diving into the nitty-gritty of Tesla's full self-driving hardware, software, neural nets, and timeline. And so I want to welcome James back on the channel. Welcome.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So we have a super exciting episode here. We're going to probably have it in two parts. The first part and the second part, we're going to be talking about modeling. So how do we model the valuation for Tesla's full self-driving going forward, robotaxis? For this first part of this conversation, we want to focus in on kind of give a background on modeling, but also look into ARK Invest's recent model where they modeled Tesla's price target to be $3,000 in 2025. So we'll focus on that. And then the second part of our conversation, James will go ahead and he will share creating models on the fly. So he'll share two different models, how to kind of look at Tesla's full self-driving, the timeline rollout, but also valuation. And he'll kind of go through a spreadsheet, kind of make it hopefully simple for us to kind of get the gist of modeling and how important it can be. So anyways, on this first episode here, I'm curious, James, if you can give us a background. Actually, first is ARK Invest. Were you surprised at all by their price target, $3,000 2025, or did it kind of just make sense to you, or what was your reaction?
I was really unsurprised by their target, actually. I think I'm not certain. You know, hindsight is kind of a weird thing. You misremember your opinions if you don't write them down. But my guess is if you had asked me what numbers they would have come up with, I probably would have guessed something pretty close to what they did come up with. Analysts are in the business of assembling. Now ARK is a little bit different because they run their own funds, right? So they're a little bit different than sell side analysts, right? That are building a model to support a proposition in part about a stock, but mostly what they're doing is they're building a set of expertise associated with a stock. And while they have research notes where, you know, they'll put a price out and they'll put their reasoning, those are pretty much just a way to advertise their services, because really they're a reference for big institutional investors that want to get into, you know, that are interested in stuff. So an institutional investor won't necessarily look at a research note and just believe the price or just accept the price or look for validation for that price. They'll have their own concerns and interests about an equity, and an analyst basically uses the process of building a model to develop expertise with certain aspects of the business so that they can be a resource to institutional investors that want to bounce ideas off of them or ask them about particular scenarios and so forth. So a model for an analyst is a way for them of working through stuff. But the output is not so much the price target as the research itself that leads to them having the ability to discuss various aspects of the business in a sort of informed way. And I think that the public perception of models is a little bit different. The public perception, I think, of analyst models is, oh, they have this big formula and they put all these inputs in and then they predict the future from it. And we know that that's not what they're doing. I mean, if you think about what they're doing, for one thing, analysts all get really different numbers, right? Like if this process worked and analysts were all really competent and they were all looking at the same data, people would get mostly the same numbers, right? But you can tell that a lot of analysts are basically, they have a thesis. They build a model to support their thesis. And they want to argue that this stock is going nowhere or that this stock is going to the moon or whatever. And so it becomes that kind of thing. But as an investor, so like investing is my bread and butter, like managing my own portfolio. It's the thing I've done for a long time. I'm trained as an engineer. Most of my career was in engineering and it was a good career and I really enjoyed it. But for the last, I don't know, 15 years or something like that, like investing has been my whole, it's essentially all my income. And I have a particular style that I do, just for full disclosure. Like I'm just interested in investing in things where I feel like I personally have an information advantage. That is an entity where the technology is a critical component of whether they succeed or fail, because that's something I can analyze with my background and whatnot. And I, you know, I did some startup companies. I know how to read a balance sheet. You know, I've got enough basic financial understanding to be able to to integrate that into the rest of the understanding of the business. But I'm really looking at companies from a technology standpoint. If you're interested in growth companies, and if you're interested in growth tech companies, or, and it's probably, this is probably true of a lot of other categories also, an interesting way to understand the potential of the business is just to do relatively simple, like napkin math models, like a one-page spreadsheet to help yourself answer some kind of question about the business. You've got, you know, there's some large range of possibilities, you know, and you're considering an investment in this company. You want to narrow that down and decide, you know, what inputs that you're going to trust and what the range of outcomes are and what's the downside, because you've got to balance the risk and the reward in any particular investment that you get, that you're doing. So now ARK is an interesting creature because they have funds, and I think they probably are using these numbers internally, but the model is probably more of a way for them to support and display their thesis for why their funds make the investments that they do, rather than necessarily them actually like taking a bunch of data and making a decision based on the spreadsheet. Just like most people don't make their decision based on the numbers. Most people go with their gut to some extent, but a spreadsheet model can help you keep yourself honest. Right. Like if you find yourself building a model to justify the valuation that you believe is appropriate for the entity, and you find yourself having to like sandbag the numbers, or if you find yourself having to inflate numbers in order to make those numbers work out, that's a clue that maybe you ought to not be so confident in your own thesis. Or alternately, that, you know, if you're not sure that something's going to go and you, you know, but you're looking for, you know, the kernel of truth that's hidden in all the data that's out there. Or if you're getting conflicting information from different sources and you can use a little bit of math and a little bit of thinking to try to separate out what you're hearing from different sides of some sort of decision that you're looking at. So I thought ARK, they happen to come out with their model. I like to look at other people's models to understand them. So I spent a good bit of time yesterday going through ARK's models and taking them all apart, trying to figure out what they were putting in, what they were trying to understand, and like, why did they get the results that they did? So I thought, you know, we were going to do this call anyway, that might be an interesting topic. So I thought I'd start with that. And maybe, you know, depending on how long that goes, maybe we can fill this whole first conversation with it.
Awesome. Yeah,
what do you think?
Let's go for it. Yeah. I think, ARK's model, I think, is interesting because a few reasons for me personally. One is they were early to catch kind of the potential of full self-driving with their earlier price target of $1,400 in 2024. This was like, I think, probably even a year and a half ago or so. And I was actually surprised by, you know, just their ability to kind of be ahead of the pack in terms of analysts. You know, usually analysts won't recognize a new technology unless it's really adopted, you know, in full. But ARK was able to see how transformative, you know, full self-driving robotaxi could become to incorporate in its models. And then what's also interesting is just the past year or two, ARK has like skyrocketed in its popularity, and it's the amount of money that they're managing and their influence too. So they're kind of, you know, a trendsetter. But it's going to be interesting, I think, to dive into and hear your perspective on kind of their assumptions and kind of how those assumptions lead to certain, you know, valuations. So yeah, go ahead. And I think, do you want to go ahead and screen share to look at?
It should be shared to you right now.
All right, let's go for it.
Can you see it?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, so you can go to GitHub and you can just grab ARK's model, which is what I did. I dumped it into Google spreadsheets here. I think the settings on this model that we're looking at right here they're the default ones that you will get if you download ARK's model. I played around with a couple of things, so you'll see some notes that I stuck in here, but almost everything here is the raw model. So if we just look at, so let's see, overview. So it's a five-year model where they look at the years between now and 2025, and the goal, the core output of the model is a share price for 2025, right? And so you can see that right here. They've got it prominently on they so the first couple of pages, they have a disclosure and a table of contents that basically explain how to use a model. Now, they supply this model in a form where they tell you there's instructions. It says you can change these values if you want to change them. These are the inputs to the model. You can play with these and explore, which is great. It's awesome that A, they're putting the code out there, and B, they're structuring this model and they're providing instructions so that people can play around with them themselves to really try to understand this model. I think that's a super valuable service. And it actually shows that they have a lot of confidence in their thesis, right? They're not using the model as a filter for getting people to come talk to them so they can sell them stuff. They actually have enough confidence in the thesis that they'll give you a model that has their parameters in it, with the confidence that when you play around with this model, you're probably going to come to similar conclusions to them. Obviously, they're not going to give you a model, which is from a business standpoint, they wouldn't want to give you a model that would lead you to believe something very different from the thesis of their own fund. It wouldn't be a good sales tool to do that. Okay, so on the third page, this is the one they call Tesla valuation. They kind of have a summary. And when you load it by default, they show you they've got these sort of five core parameters right here. And then there's lots of detail parameters. And the core parameters are these numbers they mention over here. And then they show you, like, for the illustrated bear case and the illustrated bull case, like what these numbers would be. And so you can see these numbers are set to the bull case as we start. So here's the bull case that they've got. And you can see this is an output, the stock price, in the share price, which they would predict given all the assumptions they currently have in the model. And we can walk through this and play with the assumptions and see how it affects that number. And that's a great exercise to do, to try to understand, you know, if I'm an investor and the thing that I care about is like what this stock is going to be worth in 2025, then playing around with the numbers in here and seeing how much it affects the stock price can help you figure out what's worth worrying about and what's not worth worrying about. And so we'll just start with kind of one example. So all of these blue things are things that are inputs to the model that we can play around with and change. And then all this black stuff down here is stuff that the model calculates. And you can see they've broken this into, they have the electric vehicle business, the core business here. Oh, by the way, so this is columns D, E, F, and G are hidden. And those are the years 21 through 24. So this is just the way that ARC distributes the model. If I can click a button here and reveal those. But right now we're just looking at 2020 and 2025. So those are the two columns that we have right here. So these are the calculated numbers. So you could imagine that these numbers, these are all real numbers that from 2020, because obviously ARC knows all those numbers. And then these are the 2025 numbers for the individual things that are predicted by their model. And you can click on any one of these cells, and unfortunately this isn't super big, but you can see the formula that they use for each one of these as you walk down. Studying these formulas will help you understand how they're deriving these numbers. And that's after you do a first pass through the model and you decide what you think is important and what's not important, you can go back and you can look at the formulas and you can try to understand how these things that seem important are, how ARC is calculating those. And that will lead you to the cells that have the inputs. And when you look at those inputs, you can see if the assumptions if the assumptions make sense. So this, okay, so we'll expand this a minute. So this, I just brought out the other 4 years. So you can see 21 through 24 is now here. And so if we go down to where they're doing the calculations, just for example, you can see that they have basically this updating formula here, which is the same for each one of these, where they're just basically applying a growth factor. So they start with the number of cars that got made in 2020, and then they've got this pretty straightforward formula that they apply again and again and again, and they get these, you know, each intervening year gets, they incrementally calculate the subsequent year's production based on the growth rate that they assume. And the growth rate's an input parameter that we can go take a look at. Okay, so I'm going to close that back up because it's easier to look at. Okay. So, I don't want to spend a huge amount of time going on this because we've only got an hour or so, and this could really be a huge time sink to go through. But just along those lines of like what's important and what's not important. So if we go up here and we look at this, you know, there's a $4,128 stock price in their bull case. Oh, incidentally, as a slight digression, ARC does this as a Monte Carlo model. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what a Monte Carlo model is and how they do it. But roughly speaking, a Monte Carlo model is where you pick a set of variables, and you're going to vary them over some range, and you pick them with some statistical distribution, and you look at all the model's predictions that come out, and you look at them as kind of a statistical sample of future possibilities. And then you can look from things that are least likely to things that are most likely based on the probabilities that you chose, and kind of get a spectrum of possibilities. So this helps you not only understand the bear case, but the sensitivities that the model has, and also not only understand the bull case, but also understand the bear case. Understanding bear cases is always really important because they represent the risk in your model. So you want to understand not just what does it take to make this company do well and succeed, but what could kill it, right? And how likely are those things? Because that's the risk that you take when you make an investment. Okay, so anyway, just going down to Tesla insurance right here. So they have this top line number, which is percent of cars sold with insurance. So say I want to look at this $4,000 figure, and I want to ask myself, how important is the insurance business? So ARC has taken the time to investigate the insurance business and plug a bunch of numbers in here and figure out a model that works for it, research all the background and so on. So, and an easy way for me to just turn that off is I can just change this number to zero. Because obviously, if 0% of the cars from 40% have insurance, well, you know, everything else gets zeroed out, you can see. So I go back up here, 4098. Okay, so in my bull case, I eliminate the insurance business, and it made a $30 difference on a $4,000 stock price. So that's like a 1% change, right? So that's a downside. You know, what if the insurance business went to zero and wasn't the 40% that? So we'll go to the other extreme. Now, obviously, there are a lot of numbers in this insurance model, and not, you know, I'm just playing with one of them to basically turn on and turn off the insurance business. You could look at the other parameters that go in. And if you know something about insurance, which is not me, you might look at some of these and say, oh, that number should be higher, this number should be lower. And maybe you would come up with a different view of the future possibilities of the insurance business. I'm just looking broadly at how much does the business suffer if insurance doesn't work, and how high could it go if it shoots the moon? And, you know, ARC has their numbers in here, but let's just go to the super bull case. I mean, if 40% is a bull case, well, 100%, that should be an even better bull case. And sure enough, all these numbers get bigger. So we go up here and we look, and now it's 4172. So once again, it's a $30 difference in the stock price. So if the insurance this is my takeaway, just looking at this simple model that ARC put some effort into trying to understand, is that the difference between unreasonably good insurance business and an unreasonably bad insurance business is a 1% change in the bull thesis. Okay, so for me, 1% is in the noise. Like, my general feeling is that if we look at a stock price 5 years out, and if you can forecast that stock price plus or minus a factor of two on a growth company, you're doing pretty good. So 1% is probably, this is my opinion, right? And other people are going to feel differently about this. But my opinion is that for a 1%er isn't really worth spending much time on. So, you know, insurance is a theme that ARC wants to investigate. They put it in their model. It's great. I can play around with it and try to understand the potential. But I sort of look at this and think, I'm not going to worry about insurance too much as part of my thesis. You can go to other things too. Like, for instance, obviously, ARC is pretty bullish about the number of cars. And we can look at this. You know, they see 10 million, they, you know, 2025, 10 million cars. And once again, if I expand this out, can see that they're going from, you know, 500 to 820. And this seems to be kind of the bullish side consensus. Like, this is 820 is like in the ballpark of the number that Elon and Zach floated, I think, in the Q4 call, right? And then 1.55, you know, if they build out Berlin and the Texas Gigafactory, like, you would sort of expect to see a lot of growth in the next couple of years or something like that. So these seem kind of reasonable. Now, people might quibble about, well, yeah, okay, once you get to 3, maybe it's harder to keep growing. Maybe you don't get to 10 when we look at this sequence. Maybe you do. Anyway, we could go in and we could change these numbers. I'm not going to do that right now, but you can click on these buttons. You can see what the formulas are. They're applying the same formula from 1 year to the next year. And you could just go in here and change the formula. Like if you would like to say, yeah, I think that, you know, this is a good number for 2023, but 2024 and 2025, it's going to be harder to scale at that rate. Well, you can change this formula a little bit to derate these, and the rest of the model will just work. So you can use this model to sort of explore those ideas. If you look at this model and there are parts of it you're having a hard time swallowing, or that you think are too low. Okay, let's hide those again. Okay, so how's this going, Dave? Is this making sense?
Yeah, pretty good. I mean, can you go ahead and let's change the growth rate? I think they had a max of 90%.
Yeah, okay, so let's look at how they do growth just to make sure that we understand what kind of change we're making. Balance sheet, margin, insurance assumptions, ride hail, autonomous, valuation assumptions, electric vehicle business. Okay, capital efficiency. So this is basically how much they spend on factories as they grow. Mm-hmm. Max annual production increase. So this is they're probably capping the maximum increase at this number. Yeah, okay, so let's try changing this number. So, okay, so they have, if we look at their bear case, they think 65 is a bear case input to this and 90 is a bull case. So let's just for jollies, just put 65 in here. Okay, so now if we put 65 just in this number, like, so to, actually, let's go down here. We'll take a quick look and see what these intervening numbers look like when we do that. Okay, here's cars producible. So the first few, so these two didn't change. This 20 and 21 are still the same. And now we see the growth rate is lower. So yeah, Dave, it looks like your instinct that was the right number to change is correct. And so what we're basically seeing now is a slower growth rate. They're going 65% a year. And honestly, 65% a year is probably a number that most people are going to find a lot more palatable than 90% a year.
What if we, can you try lowering it to 45% max?
Sure. Annual we can do that. Growth?
Yeah. Let's see what happens.
Okay. So just, it's worth taking a step back to look at this, right? Whenever we do one of these things. So what did, when we went, so we were at 4,000 in the bull case before, we dropped this one number to 65 and now we're at 3,000. So obviously whether this number is 90 or 65 makes a much bigger difference, you know, like it makes 100 times bigger difference, or sorry, a 30 times bigger difference than whether or not insurance is a total rock star or non-existent, just scaling things. Okay, let's go to 40. Okay, and 40 is a number that you often hear people float. Like you, just to put this in context, there are plenty of analysts who feel like 40 is the number they want to put in their spreadsheet. Now, of course, analysts very strongly prefer to err. If they're going to make an error, they want to make an error on the low side. So they have a low side bias. So if analysts are floating 40, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's actually the right number to put in, but it is a number that a lot of analysts will sign up for. Okay. And we see a 2253 stock price. So that has a, you know, going from 90 down to 40 has a big impact. Yeah. And of course it does, because we know, you know, the EV business, it's a big part of Tesla's business, right? It's kind of the bread and butter. Everything else is built on that. Like FSD requires the EV business. Insurance requires the EV business. And of course, ARC's model naturally captures this. So when the EV business doesn't grow as fast, everything is impacted by that. Mm-hmm.
Let's change a couple of numbers for the percent of cars sold into human-driven ride-hail network in 2025. Let's put 10% for that. So I'm assuming that's if in the case where full self-driving robotaxis aren't working, then, you know, they have this case where people can have a human kind of driven ride-hail network. So that's like a backup to robotaxi.
So they have 40% in here. And when we change it, so that gives us a 2253 stock price. Now, and once again, I'm not pointing at the stock price because this is gospel. This is just a metric. Mm-hmm. By the amount the amount by which this is influenced. When we change a number, tells us what the connection between these two numbers is and how important that input is to this. So if I take this 40 and I change it to 10.
Okay, so
it doesn't make much difference.
Okay. Let's change.
Okay, so what do we get from this?
Yeah.
So this is an important lesson, yeah. Right? We look at this, people talk about the human ride hail night, and this is another thing that ARC floats, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that I'm not excited about a human ride hail network is because ride hail with humans driving the car is not that profitable. It's a tough business to get into because it's already dominated by some giants that are out there, right? So Tesla's totally coming from behind. Now, as an argument for, say we're pushing out FSD and we want to get it out there a little bit before it's ready to roll with nobody in the driver's seat. Okay, like I can see the argument for it as an incremental step to getting to FSD, but as a business itself, I think it's a loser for Tesla. It's not worth their time. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a pretty good example of that, right? It saves money actually. Like the stock price actually goes up when we get rid of it, right? whether that's a legitimate result, yeah. You'd have to go look at the formulas to try to understand the relationship between those two. But to a first approximation, ARC's model suggests it's not a big influence one way or the other, right, whether you have it or you don't.
Okay, let's put it zero for now, the percent of cars sold into human-driven ride-hail network in 2025.
Okay.
And let's, for percent of all Teslas and autonomous fleet in 2025, let's put 10%, see what happens.
10? Blam.
Ouch.
Okay, so what do we get from this? Having Teslas in an autonomous fleet is a very big profit center, right? So of all the numbers we look at that. That takes away more than half of the stock valuation, right? Going at, what was the number in here before? It was 60. So going from 60%, now, you know, we're very crudely flipping numbers. But the point of this exercise is to try to understand what matters to the valuation and what doesn't matter to the valuation. And so far we looked at insurance, doesn't matter. We looked at human ride hail, doesn't matter. We changed the autonomous fleet thing and it has a really big impact. It cuts it in half. And this is just with the assumptions that they have in here. So an assertion that I will make about this is I think that ARC has sandbagged the fleet. In fact, if I go in and I put the numbers for which we'll go do in a minute, I'll show like where I think they're being super conservative. It actually would magnify this effect, right? So if I'll just go ahead and just skip right down to that. So they have 60% of cars in fleets. So here's the autonomous bar, right? So the way that ARC is getting to what's autonomous worth, right, is they basically say they assume a certain take rate in China and a certain fraction of the fleet in China, a certain take rate in the rest of the world, and I think the reason they do this is because ARC has observed that ride-hail companies in China, they get 10%, which is radically different from what ride-hail companies get in the rest of the world. So they want to take the market, they want to take Tesla's, they want to take the autonomous ride-hail opportunity, break it into two chunks, one for China with one set of rules, one for the rest of the world. And then they have a parameter, which is like how much of the total autonomous fleet is in China. So they're putting a third here. So this 60% comes from that number that we set above, right? It's just copied straight down here, right? Yeah, it is. And then this is how much of the fleet is in China. Now, they in other places, they have a what's the take rate in China? What's the take rate? So they're assuming that the platform fee, I call it the take rate. It should be platform fee. I should use that term. The platform fee, it's how much of the gross billings from a taxi ride does Tesla get as a platform fee? And they're assuming in the model, the way they have it set right now, it's 50% for the world outside of China and 10% for the world for China. And these are numbers that we can play with. I would argue that those numbers actually don't make sense with these other ones because of this number here. So just to walk down this stack, what ARC has done is they basically say you've got this many cars up above. They have a how many miles per car, how many billable miles does a car generate? And we can play with that number, right? But you multiply cars by miles, you get this many miles right here, 9. is that 9 million? Oh, that's the size of the fleet. Sorry. So this is 9 million cars in the fleet at this point. Yeah. So these are, so the 110K, this is in this case, this is the median of the range of miles that they think are doable on a taxi. So this is kind of the mid range of ARC's estimate for what a robotaxi can do. And then this is the total number of miles. So this would be 635 billion billable miles. Then, so here's the 50% cut outside of China, 10% cut in China. Okay, and then here's where they calculate what that means. So then you multiply the take rate, or sorry, the platform fee by the number of miles, and you get this. So this is the total number of ride-hail miles. This is just copied down. So in this case, they're using 80 cents per mile. Now they actually, so this spreadsheet automatically, ARC has a thing. This is a slight digression. I apologize. ARC has a thing where they, in their model, and this is something that I had talked about before, like when you first, if you don't have a lot of taxis out there, human ride hail sets the price envelope. As you have more autonomous taxis out there and they're just competing among themselves, the price comes down because they can operate for 15 or 20 cents a mile. And the human ride hail services, they have a floor of maybe $2 a mile, which is set by driver wages, right? So they basically have this table where they say, this is the price we're going to assume given this number, this many miles, and this is billion miles. So basically up to a billion miles, they're going to assume you can get $4. Up to 10 billion miles, they're going to assume $3. Up to 30 billion, $2. Up to 100 billion, $1, and so on. So as the number of miles goes up, which implies that there are more taxis, more autonomous ride hail taxis on the road, they naturally bring this price down. So the 80 cents that we were looking at here, this is an interpolated figure, which is taken from that table. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So we don't want to mess with this directly. If we wanted to change something, we'd go. And in fact, all these numbers in black, you don't change them because they're the output of a formula. It's in ARC's color coding scheme. It's the blue numbers that you change. Of course, if you want to change formulas, you can, but it takes more investigation to be able to do that without breaking the model. Okay. So with 80 cents, they get gross billings of, basically 500 billion. Then they have net ride hail revenue. And let's see. So this is, if you apply the take rate, sorry, the platform fee for China and US, for China and ex-China, given the 33% split, you know, that's specified up here for China, this is the net ride hail revenue. So this is the platform fee, the total platform fee you get now. And this is the number that in this model I have the biggest problem with. So they have a 50% EBIT margin here, which is just copied from above, the EBITDA margin. So here we have a business where the gross bookings are $500 billion and the net, you know, platform fee is $180 billion. And then ARC has this magic number in here, which is just like, so how much of that do we think Tesla gets to keep after their cost of operating the network? That's what this is. And they're just saying 50%, right? In other words, we have a fleet out there of 10 million vehicles that drove 600 billion miles. And, you know, that gets us $180 billion in platform fees. And we're going to guess that that service is going to cost $90 billion to provide. Right. So they take that off. Then they have this other calculation that they do down here where they basically they deduct taxes and interest. So they deduct it in this model, 20%. They assume that you lose 20% of your profits to taxes and 6% to interest. Now, the 20% and 6%, those are two numbers that they pick at the top of the spreadsheet and they apply them to all the different businesses. I would argue, what in the ride hail ops business are you spending 6% interest on, right? That figure does not seem appropriate to me here. In fact, the whole idea that it's costing $90 billion because Tesla doesn't own these cars. They're not maintaining these cars. At most, you could say, well, maybe they're powering these cars. Maybe they provide the electricity. But if you do the map, the gross billings are 80 cents a mile. And so if we're losing 50 cents of that, we're saying this model is basically saying it's costing Tesla 40 cents a mile for every car that's out there. And I think that's way too conservative a number. Like, I don't think there's any way it costs 40 cents. That this is Tesla. Tesla doesn't own the vehicles. They don't maintain the vehicles. They don't replace the tires. Maybe they put electricity in, but electricity is only 4 cents a mile, right? So that's only 10% of the 40 cents a mile that this model is basically assuming. They're taking this as an assumption. So I would put a very different and a much higher number in.
Isn't the 80% is actually the price per mile that they get from the end consumer.
80 cents.
Yeah, 80 cents. So then
that's averaged over the US and China. It's ex-China and China. Yeah.
So 50% platform takes it, they take 40%. ARC is assuming out of the 40 cents, 20 mm-hmm. cents is going to cost to operate, right, the robotaxi. So it's actually 25% of the ride hail revenue is going to cost of operating, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Sorry, I spoke. Yeah. So 80 cents is the raw fee.
Yeah.
Tesla takes half of that. So Tesla's taking 40 cents. And then, and so 20 cents of that is going into, yeah, that's right, I was off by two. I still think it's way too high.
Well,
once again, electricity, like I can see that being a significant cost if Tesla covers electricity as part of their platform.
Yeah.
But still, it's 4 cents out of 20 cents, right? So where's the other 16 cents going? If you sit down and you try to figure out, well, how many people can they hire for $90 billion? It's a ridiculous number. Like, it's way more people than you would need because it's a service, mm-hmm. you know. When you look at, when I saw this number, I went looking for some comparables. So I went to look at what Apple's revenue, what Apple's margin is in their service business, what Amazon's margin is in their service business, and what Google's margin is in their service business. And they're more in the 70% range, right, than they are at this. And I would argue that, like, I actually think you can get closer to 80%, especially the way that Tesla does this kind of stuff, right? Okay. Tesla's not a customer service heavy.
Okay, so for that number, I mean, that's just for these are for cars that other people own though, right? This is not for Tesla owned cars, because Tesla owned cars, they take the full 80 cents per mile.
You would presume that they would take the whole thing, yeah.
I mean, they might have some financing costs.
One of my complaints about the China model on this, right, is that if China's take rate is 10%, I mean, because the service Tesla's providing here, you know, if other people own the cars, is basically data centers and, you know, internet connections and an app.
Yeah.
And maybe customer service for those things, right? Like, those are the core things. So they've got, you know, they have this data set infrastructure. They have these developers that develop the website, and they have some customer service people that are the front on that kind of stuff. And I could easily imagine, because data centers scale pretty well with money. Developers, they scale way sublinear. Like, if you have twice a data center, you don't need twice the developers, right? You might need some more, but you don't need twice as many. And customer service, now that could scale with the number of customers, but then there's a question about, like, how much, like, you know, when was the last time you talked to a customer service agent at Uber, right? Yeah. It doesn't happen. They direct everybody into the app. They try to solve everything that way. And if everybody's using the app, then once again, you don't have a huge customer service thing. So I think this number let me finish that thought.
Okay, great.
So the thing is, if you actually back out the numbers on China on this thing, and you assume that the cost scaling is the same in China as it is in the United States, I keep using the US for everything outside of China. But if you assume that China is one-fifth the platform fee of the rest of the world, China has to operate at a loss under this model, right? There's no other way to really understand it. And they won't operate. I mean, there'd be no point. It would be cheaper. It's way cheaper for Tesla to just own all the cars in China. Right. There's no way that the financing deal that they would get for just owning all the cars in China wouldn't be a good deal, because under this model with the 10% platform fee in China, they're making so little money on the thing that they're way better off just owning the cards in China and taking 100% of the platform fee, right? I mean, making the whole fee the platform fee. So I would argue that the set of assumptions that is going into this model in this particular corner case are just kind of weird, right? And I like to go through, stick my own numbers in and see, you know, like what the possibilities are. So
a couple notes on this. On their model of the 80 cents, 40 cents is a platform fee. The owner of the car gets 40 cents. So I guess the owner of the car would take care of maintenance and electricity, maybe, and other stuff. Maybe that will cover for that. And then Tesla would take the 40 cents. But then I understand your point of view is like they don't need like that 40 cents. You know, they're not going to spend 20 cents of that on, you know, just operating costs because it's...
Well, if they are, what would it be going to?
Yeah, exactly. So it'll be probably a lot higher margins, or they could reduce the platform fee to something like 30% of the total take rate, you know, pass on more the profit to the owners.
There are lots of scenarios you can work through, and you kind of have to go through the model and ask yourself, does this number, like, what's the real scenario here? Like, what is this numbers? What would it look like in the real world if these were the numbers? And that was the thing where I said, like, you can get into these weird corners. Like, so when ARC did their Monte Carlo thing, you know, they vary a bunch of, they treat all the inputs as if they're independent because, I mean, there's reasons why you want to approach it that way. But you can get, if you get two or three parameters that are a couple of sigmas out from the center in like ways that don't make sense, you get some nonsensical outputs. Like Rob pointed out, Malda on Tesla Daily, he did a quick little walkthrough and he pointed out that, you know, some of the models that ARC, that some of the Monte Carlo runs that they did had Tesla making like 100 million cars, right? Which like, that's not going to happen in 2025. Yeah. And then I went through and I looked at some of them. Some of them have negative stock prices, like the lowest stock price is minus $550. That's not going to happen, right? Yeah. So you can get kind of nonsensical.
Some Tesla key people might disagree.
I just want to point out that the numbers that we're looking at here, these are not necessarily a set of numbers where a human being at ARC sat down and validated the scenario, made sure that all these numbers make sense when taken as a group. Mm-hmm. This bull case, it's a sample from, when they do their Monte Carlo model, they get a spectrum of results and they basically divide it into four chunks, four quartiles, right? And they, you know, their expected case is the one in the middle. And then the ones that are at the first quartile and the third quartile, they call the bear and the bull cases, right? So I believe that these numbers are a random sample of a case that is in the bull category. It's near the third quartile. So I think if you ask Tasha to make sense of this, she would not be able to give you a narrative for these because it's the output of a Monte Carlo process. So this is defending ARC, the numbers that are in ARC's model. But one of the things that you can do, take their number and play with it, is you can construct your own scenario that you think makes sense to you, put those numbers in here, and then you'll get a sense of like what their math would give you in the narrative that you think makes sense.
And that's kind of what we're doing right now. One other note about China, I think I've read, I'm not sure if it was in this model or another kind of presentation, I think it might have been in their 2021 big ideas, but they're saying that in China, the average price for ride is 50 cents in a or 50 cents per mile, and the platform fee is 25 cents. So it's actually, and they're comparing it to, I think, the rest of the world, which is like $1.85. And so the competition in China is number one, extremely tough because the costs are so low. And then second, I've noticed actually ARC has commented that they think the Chinese government is going to show favoritism to the domestic players in that market. Sure. So it'll be increasingly difficult. So that's kind of some context on why I think, you know, they're having a different set of things.
Once
for
again,
China.
It seems unlikely that Tesla will run the rideshare businesses at a loss, right? So you have to come up with a set of numbers that allow them to at least make their money back. And there is this question that they don't have to use the same model in China that they use every place else. If you can't profitably have a middleman who is the fleet operator and be competitive, and you know they probably can, but if you couldn't, they could own the fleet, right? Because that there's all the other option is we keep the car, we don't sell it to somebody else, or we sell it to some, you know, subsidiary that gets financing, buys the car from the factory, and then operates it as a fleet and takes 100%. Because if your alternative is 10x less revenue, it might be super attractive. Most of these models, like even in this model, if the gross billings are 80 cents a mile and the car is going 110,000 miles, then the cars, the gross billings per car, $90,000 a year, right? It's twice the cost of the car. So now if your choice is, well, I can take 9,000 of that, right? Or I can take all 90 and own the car. It's a no brainer. You know, if the fundamental margin on the business, because operating the car is low, like the car will pay for itself in a year, even under this model, right? That's why I come back to the whole thing that, like, you know, there are ways in which the scenario that we have from this particular Monte Carlo sample don't make sense. If these were the numbers that you would get, you would just own the car, right? Because, you know, it would be super easy to finance that car and you'd make, you know, many times. 3 times, 5 times, sure. your net revenue would go way up.
Sure. I want to change a few other inputs. So I think one of the things is, I think regarding the model of 60%, let's say, of cars being in the autonomous, you know, robotaxi network. I mean, one angle you could say that's pretty optimistic if, for example, there are different areas where of density, where, for example, a ton of people in Silicon Valley will own Teslas. And at a certain point, it won't make sense to put your Tesla in the robotaxi network if it's already just completely saturated, right? And then there'll be people in rural areas who, you know, there might not be a robust network that gets a lot of usage, right? And so there's a lot of discrepancy on the geography and the how everything is just distributed. So let's go back to this model. And if you don't mind going up to that one section of the 60%, what if we...
undo recent changes. Okay. Resetting the model to the base parameters.
All right. So let's take a little bit of a bearish view and see what happens.
So we went to 65%. So it started at 90.
Yeah.
So yeah, 90% production increase. That seems pretty bullish to me. Yeah. I would go more conservative on that because I mean, I don't think it's impossible that they could do that. It's definitely a bull case. Yeah. And like the idea that you can approximately double every year.
Yeah. So wait, let's say 50%. Okay. 50% max annual production increase for a little bit more of a critical attitude.
Oh, I wanted to do one other thing, which I didn't do yet, which, we didn't test how important, the autonomy was. So if we go back here, if we put ARC's numbers in here, so we got a $4,000 price target. And this is with that 50% platform fee, which is here, autonomous EBITDA margin. Okay. So let's say that that's 80%. Okay. So here we are at 50%, we got this $4,000 price target. Now, if we go to 80%, which I think is a more likely number, but people may differ, that's a $6,000 stock price. Okay. So it had a 50% impact on the valuation of the company if I assume 80 instead of 50. So obviously this number is really important, right?
Yeah.
Like if you want to pick a number to get right in this model, get that one right.
Yeah, but okay, on the flip side though, let's lower the platform fee from 50% to 30% though, you know? Because in some ways I think maybe a 30% might actually be a little bit more realistic. I think Elon was quoted as saying that with rideshare, their goal isn't, or with robotaxi, the goal wasn't to maximize profit per se, right? It was to let owners, you know, have a good share.
We could say, you said that it was 25 in China now, right? So what if we make China 25 and we make the rest of the world 30? Like that's just a different scenario.
Well, actually, no, it's not 25%. It was 25 cents per mile was the platform.
Oh, it's 50% then.
So
because you said it's 50 cents.
It was still 50%. But yeah, it was 50 cents per mile. Yeah.
So it's 50%.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah. I mean, regardless, I guess 30%.
Okay.
So what happens then to?
Oh, if we do 30 on both of them, right? Yeah. Okay. So now you've got 34.89. So it goes down, right? Because of course the platform
fee
is.
Yeah.
All right. But once again, that's still with 50. If we put 80 in here, right? If you know, it's harder to get an 80% margin if you've got a 30% fee, obviously. But let's go with that. We could go later and think about what those. That's a $5,000 price, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So, this was a takeaway that I was trying to get to, and I wanted to demonstrate with the model. If you look at Tesla's valuation, FSD is you're most sensitive to the success of FSD and as we're exploring right here, the business parameters of FSD, like, because the upside in FSD is so large that multipliers against that move the stock price, they move the enterprise value hugely. And one of the things about the model that I personally built myself was, like, I pretty much throw everything else away, right? If FSD succeeds or doesn't makes much bigger difference to Tesla in the models that I do than whether the energy business succeeds or doesn't succeed, for instance.
Sure.
The energy business is a big business.
Yeah, especially in the next 5 years, you know, because the energy business is still, you know, kind of marginal in its total revenue. So let's go back to this, the 60% percent of the cars in the autonomous network. Let's drop that to I think 60 is optimistic considering the challenges of it being distributed. Let's drop it to hypothetically 20%.
First, let's talk about the max annual production increase. You want to leave that at 90?
Yeah, let's do 50% max
annual. You want that to be 50?
Yeah. And then percent of all Teslas, let's drop it to.
So incidentally, 20. Historically, this number is north of 60.
Sure.
Right? It's 58. No, sorry, it's 58. So 50 is a fine number. Sure. So here's a thing to just take a step back and ask. So this process that you're doing, we can just play around with the numbers and see what the sensitivities are. To a first approximation, we did that. And now we've moved on to the phase of, like, what are the numbers that feel right to me? And there's kind of three different numbers you want to put in. There's the how bad could it be? Then there's the, what do I think is a right number? And then there's the, how good could it be number, right? So which one are we doing right now, Dave?
Oh yeah, no, this is a little bit on the, let's be cautious, kind of a little bit, I want to say bearish, but let's say.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, you want to do a 4?
Yeah, let's do a 3.5 in terms of, you know, kind of less pessimistic.
Okay,
a bit more pessimistic.
50% max.
Yeah.
And so now here's the thing, right? And this is one of the reasons why you do Monte Carlo. Yeah. If you take all your assumptions and you put all of them at 3.5, you actually get kind of a more, because a lot of these are multiplicative effects, right? Mm-hmm. Usually if you get the 3 out of 5 case, it's because one or two of the important numbers is 3 out of 5. It's not because all the numbers are 3 out of 5, right? So that's just something to keep in mind. If we go through here and we put the 3 out of 10 number or 4 out of 10 number in all the categories, that we're really picking a 2 out of 10 model, right? Because they're multiplicative.
Got it. Yeah. Right? Well, let's just change one more. Let's do the percent of all Teslas in an autonomous fleet in 2020. Let's do that at 20%. Because
let me make a suggestion.
Yeah.
Which is a good place to start is, like, what do I think is the middle number? And go through and put the middle numbers on everything. And then adjust the other numbers up or down to make your bull case, adjust one or two of them.
Sure.
So in other words, if you got 6 numbers, right, and you think that, you know, the right zone for each one of them is around 5, put your 5s in for all of those numbers, right? And then if you want to be conservative, pick a couple to be conservative on.
Got it. Yeah, actually, I think a 50% annual production, it could be
feels
considered
like
a 5. And then let's do the percent of all Teslas in 2025 is 20%. Just because I think that's a decent, I mean, it could be higher, like 60%, but I think 20% is not bad because it's going to take a while to scale, I think.
Let's talk about that a minute, because I would disagree with that analysis.
Okay, yeah.
And here's where I come from. Mm-hmm. If FSD works, right, and you can put it on a car in your neighborhood or whatnot, there's going to be some price, you know, if your car can drive 100,000 miles a year and the bill rate is at that particular point in time, like if it's $1, right? That's $100,000 a year that that car makes, which means the net present value of that vehicle and service is probably like $300,000. That means if you own a car and you paid $50,000 for it and you have it in a garage, it would make sense for somebody else to come to you and say, I will give you $300,000 for that car. So when you consider the Silicon Valley person who wants to have their own Tesla, right? Now, maybe they paid $50,000 for it because they bought it before FSD took off, right? But you have to ask yourself the question, would they turn down $300,000 for that car in order to have the car in their garage? Because that's the decision they're facing at that point, right? If the commercial value of this vehicle is substantial, and that depends on the market being there and the bill rate to be relatively high. Now, I would argue, especially in the early days of FSD, that the market is definitely, because the market's not saturated at that point, right? And the bill rate will be fine, like it'll be a dollar or something like that until we start saturating. Because you can just get that in the United States. I mean, Uber's like $2.50 on average, or it's $2 something, right? So a dollar is a good price. There's plenty of market at that price. So now, that said, you know, there's several million cars out there. What fraction of people are going to forego getting paid to selling their car into a taxi fleet, right? Because they want to have their own car. There will certainly be some people who will not consider that a lot. And maybe $300,000 isn't the right price. But even if it's $100,000, right? Like your average Model 3 owner, like they could buy a nice car for $100,000. Maybe not a Tesla, but at that point in time. But so anyway, I want to make the case for when the market gets going.
Yeah.
But before the market is saturated, there's actually a ton of incentive for people who own Teslas that are FSD capable to use them that way, because there's a lot of money on the table, right? Even if they want to have their own Tesla, they're going to be making the decision to have their Tesla at the cost of foregoing this source of income that they could have, right? So I think it's true. People want to have their own cars. I like having my own car. I don't want to send it out and have a lot of strangers riding around in it, right? But, you know, you could have another car, right? And your Tesla could be making, you know, $100,000 a year for you or something, or 50,000, or, you know, however that number works out.
Okay, so another angle, or some other side points is, for example, Silicon Valley, it might get saturated pretty fast if you think about it. I mean, just the amount of Teslas, you know, let's say by 2025, it might be saturated and you might not get nearly, you know, what you might get in other areas. And so it might reduce actually the incentive for people and the economics. And for example, take Europe, for example, the regulations might take a while. So to really, you know, get through all this, get through robotaxi. So it might, to get robotaxi in all of the countries in Europe in 2025, there might be some, you know, some headwinds. But hypothetically, let's just say, you know, we put in 20%. How much does this crash the stock price? actually, the one...
25.
The one below, normal. Yeah, that one. Oh, yeah. Percent of all Teslas. Actually, it doesn't. The other one doesn't really matter. The
human-driven. Yeah, 0 doesn't have an impact. 1459.
1450, okay. So it radically, it makes a big difference, the percent of Teslas in the robotaxi fleet, whether it's 20% or 60%, is going to radically shift.
Because the business is going to, it's a multiplier, right? Yeah, exactly. The size of the business is how many cars you have, and that's the percentage of the fleet, which goes into, which goes into that. So let's, 20%, if 20% of cars are in the fleet, right? And we go down here and we look at what is ARC is going to guess on their autonomous model, that the bill rate is $1.10 and the cars are driving 100,000 miles, right? So every person who has a Tesla in their garage, who's not using it for, the other thing is we have Tesla's take rate at, what do we have the rate at here? Is it platform fee? Yes. We have the platform fee at 30. So the owner keeps 70%. Okay, so your car could be driving 110,000 miles, making $1.10 a mile. So that would be $120,000 a year, and you would get to keep 70% of that. So $80,000 a year. So basically everybody who you're guessing that 80% of people who own Teslas, when you put 20% here, the 80% of people would rather have a Tesla than get $80,000 a year in cash.
Well, ultimately, obviously, I think that 30% take rate was for the human driven. Was that for the human driven ride hail?
I think did we set them both to 30 or do we still have it?
Let's, I think the autonomous was 50. Maybe we changed it back.
Margin. Oh, yeah, it's still 50. Okay, yeah, so 50. Let's change them to 30. Yeah. Okay, 30 and 30. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, 1265. So that didn't, that had some impact.
Yeah. I think all I'm saying is there's going to be a transition where I don't know.
But the thing is, at every single point, the transition has to make sense, right?
Yeah.
You don't get this. The only reason that you get into a situation where you have people making super irrational decisions is because the transition has happened so fast that their decision process hasn't been able. In other words, maybe Tesla can't absorb that many cars into the network, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe, you know, the news just came out yesterday and most people don't know, you know, but it's not going to be one of those things where, like, for a solid year, people have a Tesla in their garage sitting there doing nothing when it could be earning $80,000 a year, right? I mean, every single person who owns a Tesla, that's going to be it, in this scenario where FSD works and you can put it on a car. Every single person that has one, they're going to have to make that decision. And I think the reality is you're going to get an equilibrium. There's going to be some combination of price, and there's going to be some number of combination of people who are willing to participate at that price that gets you to some equilibrium, and that equilibrium will make sense. I would argue that the equilibrium that we have in these numbers doesn't actually make sense, because I don't think that 80% of the people who buy Teslas are going to glibly let $80,000 a year go by, right? I think they would be happy to put their car in the network 50% of the time and take $40,000 of that or something, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so, 'cause most people buy Teslas, they're not millionaires, right? They're just average people. You know, they got a Tesla instead of a Toyota Camry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And $80,000 a year is a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems like, I mean, actually this has been helpful to dissect some of this, mm-hmm. some of the criteria, because it seems like a big factor is the volume of cars that Tesla can produce, right, per year. And then the percent of those cars that have been produced in history that have the hardware that are deployed in the robotaxi network, and then the unit economics of the robotaxi network, let's say the price mm-hmm. per mile, the take rate, you know, Tesla's margin, et cetera, all of that will equal some type of earnings, right, for Tesla that you could, you know, multiply it into some valuation for the company. But then to pinpoint the exact, I guess, year that the certain number of cars will be deployed with robotaxi, I mean, like, what's your take? I mean, it seems like there's going to be a range in some ways, you know? And so is it helpful to just decide, put some numbers down that you think is middle ground and to, you think, is that a plausible way, or what's your kind of take? I guess this will lead up to our second mm-hmm. part, you know, of you maybe creating a model from scratch, right, to help us, maybe more simplified model. But what are your kind of mm-hmm. overall thoughts with that?
So the process that I use when I build one of these things is, you know, you typically do this model over a number of years, and you have typically 1 year. Like, I think this happens this year, this is the next year, and whatnot. So I start with just a rough guess at what I think the middle numbers are for each category. And then I go to year one and I say, okay, you know, year one would be next year. Like, this year I have the numbers for. Okay, so my model next year, it says this and this and this. Like, does that make sense? Like, this much money, this many cars, blah, 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 blah. Is there anything that's broken in this set of assumptions in this year? And if the answer is no, you can move on to the next year. So with FSD, the place that things start getting complicated is you get to some year where you say, okay, FSD is available this year. I'm going to guess in my model that, you know, 2023, just pick a year, right? 2023 is the year when FSD becomes available. Okay, what does the world look like? Okay, we're in a world where it's all Uber, right? There are very few robotaxis. The robotaxis are out. So maybe people are a little reluctant to get into them and blah, 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 blah. But every single car that goes out makes $3 a mile, right? So the start rate is $3 a mile because it's competing with human beings, or $2. Maybe you pick $2 or something like that. So you look at the unit economics at that point. And you say, okay, so what does that mean? Assume Tesla goes with a model where they have middlemen, like they're not going to own all the cars. You know, people who already own their Tesla, now they have the option of putting the car in the Tesla network. How much money could they make if they did that, given the price that I'm going to assume the thing is? Okay, how many people would take that deal? Just reasonably guess that kind of number. Because if it's a ton of money, a lot of people will take it. And if it's not much money, not many people will take it, a relatively small fraction. So you look at the numbers that you have in that year and you tweak and you adjust them until it's reasonable, right? It's a believable number. Mm-hmm. Like I would say the, you know, a million people with Teslas in their garage sitting on $80,000 a year, like to me, that's not believable, right? I would want to adjust those numbers. Now you could adjust them a couple different ways, but I want to adjust it somehow so that people are giving up that, so that, you know, there's, I mean, you're always going to have some people who act, you know, not in a simple economic rationality, right? I just want to have my car. I don't want anybody else in my car, or it's my pride and joy. I don't want it to be scratched, or they'd just sell the car, you know. I mean, you know, there's various kinds of spaces, but there's a very non-trivial cohort of people who will look at it as a reasonable economic decision, and they'll make reasonable guesses about that. And I think, you know, if somebody comes to you and they say, you know, I'll pay you $80,000 a year to borrow your car when you're not using it, that a very large number of people will take that deal. And I would say it would be a lot more than 20% of people. Maybe it's not 90%, right? Yeah. But like $80,000 is a lot of money. Yeah. Now you get this thing where, like, if enough people take the deal, the price of the deal comes down and you hit some equilibrium, right? And so that's the number, like in year two, I want to look for. Like, what's the number that where the price comes down and there's still enough people taking it, right? But it's not, you know, it's not the no brainer that it is $80,000, right? But, you know, at what price does half the fleet, do half the people do it? At what price do 3/4 of the people do it? You might want to think through that process, and then you can use that as a guideline for what numbers you want to put in subsequent years. So I like to end up with a model that's got a narrative as the base case, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, the base case is, what are the numbers I think are the most likely numbers to occur? Not the ones that will happen if everything goes perfectly, or the ones that happen if something terrible happens, but just kind of like the middle number on that. And then you can go through and adjust random numbers of like, oh, so this year, you know, a Tesla runs over a toddler, you know, and we have this huge backlash. And like, so, you know, how does that impact the model the next year? Like, how long does it take to recover? Or, you know, this is the year Tesla gets nationalized, you know, because they're just making too damn much money, or they get kicked out of China or whatnot. I mean, you can think of, you know, whatever your scenarios are that you want to model as your, you know, extreme downside models. But I like to start with the middle case.
Awesome.
And I like my middle case to make sense.
Cool, man. This is actually fascinating stuff, because it's, one side is you have to have an information advantage on technology that most people believe is unbelievable. It's not going to happen, right? With autonomous driving. And actually, and then you have to have a sense and a model and a grip of kind of its timeline and how it can roll out, right? The maturation of this technology into the mass market, which could be different than just a theoretical technology. And then you have to go into, like, what does this mean in terms of revenue and valuation, right, for the company and the stock? So it's a marrying of various different things all put together, you know, to come up with a unique angle. So in our next part, right after this, we'll go into diving into the models. I think you shared earlier you wanted to...
Yeah, we're going to build some models.
Yeah, build some models that
we'll build a couple of simple models just to explore building your own model. We looked at ARCs. I actually want to do one more thing because I went to all the effort of doing this yesterday, and there will be some people who care.
Yeah.
So this will run a few minutes longer.
Yeah, go for
it. That is... How did they do the Monte Carlo stuff in this?
Oh, yeah.
So we looked at this thing. So with a Monte Carlo model, you want to be able to vary your inputs with some sort of statistical distribution. And the usual thing that you do is you use a normal distribution, right? So you pick a number that you think is the center of the center case. And this is what ARC did. They have like their median case, this minus one sigma, this is their bear case, where if a parameter that varies to the low side makes the stock price go down, that's a bear case, you know, boundary. They have a bull case boundary, which is plus one sigma. And then they have limits that they put. So for each one of their parameters, they have a min. They have a minimum number. Like, it doesn't make any sense to go below this. They have a maximum number. It doesn't make any sense to go above this. And between those two, they draw a Gaussian where the plus one sigma and minus one sigma are the bull case and bear case, respectively. So I'm just showing this is a Gaussian. This is so using a Gaussian, or this is a normal distribution, or the bell curve. This isn't the normal way that this is done. It turns out that that parameters that vary freely in nature and are independently, this is the most common distribution that they have. So it's the one that statisticians just pick as their go-to case. Lots of things are not this shape, but it's the assumption that people go with in the absence of a compelling reason to pick a different one. So we've got these. So what are the parameters? There's some things where you have a dependency. So remember we talked earlier about how, like, the more cars there are on the road, the more miles are getting driven, the price comes down because of competition. So ARC, they basically built tables for a couple things. The other things they didn't want to run into is, like, you can only sell so many Model S's and X's into the world, right? That was another limiter that they had. So they built a table, which is like, how many can the world absorb? And we're going to assume that they can't sell more than that. So they built another table where they've got each of these various categories of vehicles, and they figured out what the maximum demand is for those. And that's what this other table is. So they use these tables in their Monte Carlo model because otherwise they get too many nonsensical cases. Mm-hmm. So this lets them do a certain amount of coupling between variables. So these are the Monte Carlo inputs, and you can see for each one of these, like, here's the gross margin one, right? They have the minimum. If they randomly vary a parameter, and if they randomly vary the gross margin parameter, and it goes below 20, they clip it at 20. They won't let it go below 20. And if it goes above 80, they clip it at 80. They don't let it go above that. And the statistical distribution is set such that obviously 50% would be the middle, and 40% would be one sigma down, and 60% would be one sigma up. So, and they use bell curves for each one of these. And so you can go through this, what would be an interesting one. So here's the Wright's law learning rate, right? So they use Wright's law as a formula for understanding how Tesla's cost to manufacture vehicles goes down over time. So, like, what's their cost of goods sold as a function of how many vehicles have been made. And so their worst case scenario, the minimum they're willing to consider seriously is 10%. The maximum they're willing to consider seriously is 20, and then 14 and 17 are the plus and minus one sigma. That makes sense?
Yeah. Are they saying for every doubling of production, the cost of goods will go down 10%?
Yep, in their that's minimum, what
and then maximum is 20%.
It's not doubling of production. It's doubling of cumulative vehicles that have been built.
Oh, okay. Got it.
So in their model, they keep track of, like, how many got made last year, how many are we at? And then they interpolate on their Wright's curve to figure out, like, what's the cost of production this year. And then as they increment the years in their model, they gradually ramp the cost of goods sold for the EVs down according to this curve.
Okay. Got it.
And so here's the thing with insurance, right? You know, obviously it doesn't make sense. Less than 0% can't take it. More than 100% can't take it. And then they have their plus and minus one sigma at 20% and 60%, right? So they're the middle of the range is 40 in this case. So anyway, if you want to play with their Monte Carlo model, you can look at this. But the main reason I'm doing this is not because I expect a lot of people to play with the Monte Carlo models. I want them to sort of understand how ARC is using this model to get to the numbers that they bring up. So that's the Monte Carlo inputs. This is the Monte Carlo. So on this page, this is where for each one of these parameters, they generate a random number. And then that random number ends up corresponding, given, for instance, we were looking at that gross margin thing, right? Here's max gross margin. So it was 20, 40, 60, 80, right? 20 and 80 are the limits, 40 and 60 are the bull and bear. So this random number here that got generated in this column generated a 56% on that statistical distribution. So they do, this is a scratch pad where I was like writing my own version of this thing to just validate that, because first when I looked at their model, I thought there were bugs in it. So I had to build my own version and verify that the results were there. It's just clunky code. But so whenever you make a change to this, like if I do something, if I update this, if I make any changes page, you can see all these random numbers changed. So every time you make a change to this page, it regenerates all the random numbers, gives you another scenario that's randomly chosen. So remember, so previously, you know, this was at 50%, 56%, right? And so I randomly changed something in the page. So the way the Monte Carlo thing works in a spreadsheet, right, is you iterate, you just recalculate this sheet 5,000 times and you log each output, right? So if you've got a set of windows for your input variables, which are reasonable, and, you know, so you basically said, this is where I think the meat of the distribution should be, right? This is my bear case. This is my bull case. 68% of all the situations will occur between those two. And then you'll have some outliers, but I'm going to clip them in order to make sure that the number makes sense. So assuming that you've done a decent job with each one of those, you know, every time you recalculate this sheet, it will randomly sample from the space of all possible models that fit those criteria, and it will generate an output. So now they did that, and here's 5,000. So they give you, they show you what the numbers are, the outputs of 5,000 models. So you can scroll down this and you can get a sense of what the things were. And we can do an interesting thing with this where we, let's see, let's make a histogram. So we can just like gross margins. So I have taken column B here and I've plotted a histogram. So that's max gross margin. So we can look in these 5,000 cases, you know what a histogram is? You know how that works? Okay. So this is just basically shows us how many models had what gross margin. So for instance, cause this is max gross margin. So for instance, at 49%, we can see there were, you know, nearly 300 models that had 49%. And when you go to, that was the highest one. So we see what the distribution of max gross margin is. So you can see they've got some here where, you know, there's some non-trivial number of cases that they considered that had 80% gross margins, right? And then they also had, you know, 20% gross margins down here on the bottom. So we can do, make adjust this chart for each one of these. So let's see, let's look at I, it's quicker to just adjust the chart by adjusting these numbers. Okay. And so like, this is the distribution of electric vehicle revenue. So looking at the histogram kind of gives you a feel for what's going on with the, like how are their assumptions manifesting in, the cases in the outputs for the model. Histogram is a nice straightforward way of looking at that. Let's see if there's anything. Okay. So yeah, share price is a good one. Let's look at S. That's one everybody can relate to. Okay. So here's the distribution of share prices. And this is where I said, you can see there are some negative share prices that come out of the model here, right? Mm-hmm. And then you can sort of see, you know, they're 3,000, 4,000 where they fall in this distribution. And you can see that there are some models that go like, you know, their home run cases go up to 10,600, mm-hmm. you know, 11,000, whatever. They've got some prices with $15,000 price targets like way out here on the tail. Anyway, so this is using histograms on this page is a way to sort of explore what is coming out of ARC's model.
All right. So question on this, on the Monte Carlo model. So what's the pros and cons? What's the advantage of doing a Monte Carlo model approach versus just doing, for example, picking a bull case, right? Showing that, picking a bear case and let's say a base case, just kind of doing a more simple model like that. Is there any advantage that's accrued by doing a Monte Carlo model?
So the thing I mentioned before, if you got a bunch of variables and you're trying to be a little conservative, a pretty common thing for a human being to do is they go through and they're like a little bit conservative on every parameter. But because it's multiplicative, what you actually get is like this pretty ugly worst case output. And that's a difficult thing to get your head around as a human being, right? Like, what combination of variables is a reasonably conservative model, and what combination is a reasonably optimistic model. And so a way to get around this is, for each variable, you say, this is kind of what I think is reasonable. This is kind of the distribution I like. Like, what's the plus one sigma and minus one sigma? And then what are the limits? Like, it can't be lower than this and it can't be higher than that. It's just like, wouldn't make any sense for it to be. So if you do that for all of your input parameters, right? And then you just randomly vary them and you see what the output is and you look at the distribution, it does that process for you. So this is a problem. If you have a model that's got like three inputs, a human being can be a little conservative on them or a little aggressive on them or whatnot, and understand how aggressive are my assumptions or how conservative are my assumptions. But once you've got more than two or three or four, you get into this zone where, like, if you've got 20 input variables, and you want a slightly conservative model, slightly, not grossly conservative, because of the way statistics work, most of those numbers, they have to vary around that center line. They're not all going to be on the low side in any real world. Some of them are going to be a little high. Some of them are going to be high. Some of them are going to be low. And if you want to be conservative, you want a certain statistical distribution of some that are a little on the low side, right? And just human intuition is really bad at making that trade-off, right? And so what happens is you try to be a little conservative, and if you got a 20 parameter model and you as a human try to go in and make it a little bit conservative, you actually get this statistically incredibly unlikely outcome to the low side. And it doesn't feel that way because you feel like you were just a little conservative on each variable. But a little conservative times a little conservative down through 20 variables multiplies out to, this is unrealistically on the low side. So of course, one of the problems with Monte Carlo models is that you have to have an understanding of what the statistical distribution of likely outcomes is. Like, we picked that bell curve, and that's what people do. ARC picked the bell curve. The bell curve is the standard way to go about doing this kind of thing, right? But some of these things, they don't fall on a bell curve. And then it starts to get complicated. So one of the things you have to constrain yourself to is, like, don't put a parameter in the model and model is a bell curve if you don't reasonably believe it can be a bell curve, right? And actually, and we'll get to this in the next video, like, my approach is to go in the opposite direction. It's like, do a sensitivity analysis, which is what we just did on ARC's thing, and then get rid of everything you don't need, right? Because the easiest way to get a better output is, don't make it so complicated that you don't understand the consequences of fiddling with the numbers, right? So how can you go about building simple models that give you useful information, right? And so that's what we'll do in the next video.
Yeah, definitely. Fascinating stuff. I mean, it seems like the more variables you put, you know, say 20 variables, to get so complex, mm-hmm. as you're saying, you know, changing. Yeah. So you need like a model to do that. But then the other side is, maybe you don't need most of those variables, you know, a lot of them are
it's a trap.
Yeah,
too,
exactly.
Because people look at a model that's complicated and they think, oh, it must be really accurate, right? And because obviously somebody put a lot of effort into figuring out all those numbers and all those formulas, and it's totally the opposite. Yeah. The more complicated the model gets, the less likely it is to be true. And there are these subtle things. Human intuition is really bad at randomizing a pool of variables. It's really, really, really bad at doing that. And that's why you want to use a Monte Carlo model, because your intuition will betray you. So instead, take every parameter standalone, you know, figure out what, if that was the only parameter, what would be the right things for that? And the Monte Carlo model will take that thing that it will take those reasonable statements that you can make about the isolated variables, and it will turn it into a reasonable outcome for the overall model. Now, you know, the models you're going to get, they're also going to be on a bell curve, right? And the outliers are going to be dumb, right? And that's why, you know, some of these have $15,000 stock prices, which is a dumb outcome given the constraints that the ARC has built into this. And some of them will even have negative stock prices, which is a different kind of dumb, right?
Yeah. I mean, do you think, it seems like the more complicated a model, more variables, there's more likelihood, I don't know what's your take, but more likelihood mm-hmm. that the author of the model has already kind of determined the outcome and the model is used to support that like kind of, you know what I'm saying?
So all models, almost without exception, any model that's used in this kind of situation is going to be somebody essentially trying to support what they already believe. I mean, it's the nature of human decisions. I mean, people make decisions and then we rationalize them to ourselves, right? Yeah. It's this deep principle of psychology is that that with few exceptions, people do not work forward from data and make conclusions, right? They come up with a conclusion for their gut and then they look for evidence. They look for rationalizations to support that kind of thing. Yeah. And as an investor, that's a very dangerous place to get into, right? And so, so one of the things that a model helps you do is it gives you a tool to help you avoid kidding yourself about things, but also kidding yourself on both sides. I mean, I would suggest that one of the reasons that ARK's got that 50%, that's a hard coded number in here, right? That was, it's not a range variation that they got. One of the reasons they have that 50% is if they set that number much higher than that, they're going to get numbers out of the model that people are going to choke on. I mean, it's one thing for ARK to come out and say, yeah, we got a $3,000 target because that's a lot compared to where the stock price is now. And our bull case is 4,000. That's one thing. If they come out like, yeah, we have a $3,000 main target and our bull case is 10,000, right? That they're going to be a very non-trivial population of people who are going to stop listening to them when they hear that number come out, even if they believe everything that went into the model, if the model comes up with $10,000, because it seems like an outrageous proposition, right? So one of the things that analysts get into, and I think other analysts are much more prey to this even than ARK is, one of the reasons that ARK comes out with relatively high numbers is I feel like they are more data driven than a lot of other analysts are. If Morgan Stanley does a spreadsheet and they don't like the number, they do a different spreadsheet, right? I mean, they know the number they want to come out of
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And because there's a number that's going to be in the zone for their clients, where clients are still going to listen to them. They're going to take them seriously. They're going to want to talk about stuff and hear Morgan Stanley's opinion. They're going to consider it reasonably balanced. And their numbers, you know, if the real number is outside that, then they can't use the real number. It doesn't fit their business model. So I think in the case of Tesla, a lot of analysts find themselves in that position where they, you know, and this is one of the reasons I think that a lot of analysts, they don't want to touch the full self-driving thing because they do the napkin math and they get these outrageous numbers. And they're like, okay, nobody's going to buy that. I'll just leave it out of the model. Or I'll just say, well, you know, we don't really understand that. We think it's an opportunity and we're going to study it for next year, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But here's our report talking about the energy business.
Yeah, so. Makes sense. Fantastic conversation. Thank you for shedding light on ARK's model. I'm glad that they put it out there. It gives us, you know, a chance to really talk about
it. It's great. I'm super happy that they do this. Yeah. And kudos to them. This is nothing I'm doing in this conversation is a criticism of ARK's model. I think it's a super novel and refreshing thing. It's great that they put it out there. I have places where I disagree with it. I'm in a different business than ARK is. And so naturally we're going to have different requirements from the models that we build.
Yeah, definitely. Great. Let's end this part of the conversation. I can't wait to jump into part two, checking out some of the models built from scratch that you're going to lead us into. So we'll see you guys in our next episode.